Hi, so my name's Ted Macrith. I'm recently just finished my PhD at Liverpool John Moores University, and I'm now a postdoc at the University of Birmingham, working with Andrea Miglio on this really interesting ERC project, which is called astrochronometry, which is using stellar ages to try and understand the structure of the Milky Way's disk, and specifically stellar ages measured using astroseismology. But today I'm going to mainly concentrate on the work I did throughout my PhD towards trying to understand the assembly history of the Milky Way. Using numerical simulations, then also using the data from the many surveys that we have available to us now as Milky Way scientists. I'll just start my talk by kind of giving a brief overview of galactic archaeology as a thing. I mean, everyone here probably knows what I'm talking about, but it's nice to kind of review these things. So I always think about galactic archaeology as something that we kind of need in order to be able to do galactic archaeology and use it for any kind of good science. We actually need to really deeply understand the context of the Milky Way, because it's all well and good understanding the formation of the Milky Way, but then the important thing is how we can transfer that understanding to understand other galaxies. So the general sort of procedure for doing this is that we study the present-day structure of the Milky Way and make constraints using, for example, Gaia and SDSS and some of the other spectroscopic surveys that are going on now. And we make detailed constraints, which we can then go and apply to models. So we make models that meet those constraints and make new predictions. So an example I'm giving here is the work of Christina Cippini, which tried to understand the formation of the Alpha to Iron Plane, which I'm going to talk about a lot in this talk. But then essentially we kind of make those models, meet those constraints, make new predictions, and kind of repeat that process until we have this really nice detailed understanding of the Milky Way, hopefully. Of course, that's great. It doesn't really tell you a lot about other galaxies. And something that I believe is that we need cosmological simulations in order to understand what all of this means for galaxy evolution in general. So the example of a cosmological simulation that I'm showing there is Eagle. Andrew's talked in extent about the fire simulations, and I'll explain why Eagle gives you a slightly different picture of these things in a minute. But for the first part of my talk, I'm basically going to concentrate on Eagle and what that tells us about the Milky Way, perhaps. So everybody in the Milky Way who will know about this plot here, it's the Alpha to Iron Plane at the solar radius. And as Andrew pointed out, this is something that we kind of don't really understand so far, because it's very difficult to kind of produce these two populations, because we know that the processes which create these elements happen in different timescales. So alpha elements generally come from type II supernovae, which occur almost instantaneously when stars form in a given stellar population. Whereas iron generally comes from type 1a supernovae, which occur with a kind of time delay due to the fact that they're mainly formed in these binary processes. But what we see at the solar radius is that there's this distinct bimodality in alpha elements at fixed metallicity, which is very difficult to produce in a kind of closed box model. So we know these alpha-rich stars form when the star formation efficiency was high enough to form stars before any type 1a enrichment, and we know that these low alpha stars formed probably after the type 1a ejecta polluted the ISM. But it's kind of difficult to get these two things, these two tracks happening in a closed box. So we kind of need to understand, how do we get this kind of co-spatial bimodality in the Milky Way at the solar radius, and what can answering that actually tell us about the assembly and evolution of the galaxy? So I'll kind of rattle through those quickly, because Andrew touched on a few of those points. But I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the analytic models that have tried to reproduce this alpha Fe bimodality and what those things have actually told us and informed us about what we can do to try and understand this. So I mentioned the two-info model from Christina Cippini, and essentially what that says is that these two populations in alpha to iron space formed in two different episodes of infall of gas onto the galaxy. So early in the galaxy's history, they say that the gas infall should have been very rapid, and therefore causing a burst of star formation, which forms stars with high alpha to iron abundances, because they form before the type 1a's enriched the ISM. There's then a kind of hiatus in star formation, while gas is still accreting onto the galaxy, which gives you a kind of gap in this plane, because gas is accreting and changing the element abundance of the ISM, but stars aren't forming. And then once star formation kind of reignites, in a phase where the gas infall is slightly slower, you then form stars at these low alpha abundances, which will give you a star formation history that looks kind of like this. Of course, this model kind of has been refined as we've had more data, so in that kind of process that I mentioned before, And we now think that maybe these things kind of happen in parallel, but the situation might look kind of similar. You can also think of this as kind of a radial migration process. So we know that the star formation efficiency kind of sets the position of these tracks in the alpha to ion plane. So if you think of there being a kind of gradient in star formation efficiency in the galaxy, as a, so you think that there's a gradient in the gas density, that would imply that there probably is a gradient in the star formation efficiency. At different radii, would produce different tracks in this plane, which you then might be able to mix together through some kind of radial migration process and form a kind of chemical bimodality that way. And this was kind of studied a little bit in the context of numerical simulations that were done by Omer et al., and they showed that the kinematics can be kind of consistent with what you see in those planes. And this is all well and good, and it's really nice to do those things, and that actually tells us quite a lot about what's going on. But they kind of have freedom to adapt and reverse engineer the data, so it's difficult to make really solid predictions for the Milky Way and how the Milky Way fits in with other galaxies by using those kind of models. So the thing that we need to do is produce a Milky Way-like alpha to FE plane ab initio, and that will then allow us to make very nice orthogonal predictions for what's actually the Milky Way looks like and how that fits in with the rest of the galaxies in the universe. So what we want to do is kind of forward model and use cosmological simulations to do that. And I'm going to just show you how we can use cosmological simulations to maybe do that. So I'm going to talk about the EAGLE simulations. So Andrew already presented the FIRE simulations, which is kind of unfortunate for me because they look so great. EAGLE is essentially like doing a FIRE simulation, but in a huge box where you're self-consistently modeling galaxies all together. So you're doing the baryonic physics on that in that large box that Andrew showed. So instead of taking zoom kind of small volumes and re-simulating them at high resolution, you're kind of just doing a whole box at low resolution and throwing out a few of the fine details of the physics that you see in simulations like FIRE. But the great thing about this is that you actually then end up with 133 Milky Way-like galaxies at the end of your simulation, which you can then look at and try and understand the statistics of the processes that we're seeing underneath. And I think it's really important to actually use those two things together. So it's really important to do zooms and these huge cosmological simulations to actually make solid predictions for what we can see in the universe. So in the paper that I'm going to talk about today, we basically selected galaxies based on the Milky Way stellar mass, and we find 133 of those galaxies which are dominated by the disk, so kind of on this end of the Hubble diagram. And the great thing is that we track the elements, 11 elements similarly to FIRE, including the alpha elements, so it allows us to really study the chemical evolution of those galaxies at high detail. And we also do a suite of simulations which adjust the parameters for feedback and supernova enrichment, and many other different things, different parameters which are included in the subgrid models that allow us to make these galaxies. So I take these 133 Milky Way stellar mass galaxies from EAGLE, and I basically stacked them all together, selected the solar radii, or what we would imagine is the solar radius from each of those galaxies based on their scale lengths. So the scale lengths do actually differ quite a lot in this sample. But we basically wanted to take a representative sample of stars that might represent a solar radius and look at their alpha to ion planes and see if those look like anything the Milky Way. But first, what I wanted to do is just stack all of those galaxies together and look at some of the properties of the alpha to ion plane. So I'm just going to show you one example of doing that kind of process. And what I'm showing you here is the alpha to ion, the stars in the alpha to ion planes of all of those galaxies stacked together and then colored by their mean gas consumption timescale. So people tend not to really understand what I'm talking about when I talk about gas consumption timescale. It's essentially the inverse of the star formation rate. So you can kind of think of this in the simulations as it's we derive it based on the density of the gas at the time the gas particles convert to star particles. So it's almost a measurement of how long the gas particles hang around in the ISM once they've accreted into the central galaxy. And this shows you a really nice picture, which is kind of consistent with what we would expect from the kind of analytic models that I showed you before, because what you see is that the stars with very high alpha to ion ratios are the ones which have had very little time in the ISM. So they have extremely short cooling time scales, and they form their stars extremely rapidly, whereas the stars at low alpha to ion ratio seem to have been hanging around in the ISM for a long time. But the interesting thing is that these are kind of divided in this plane by the time which we put into the simulations as the half-life time for type 1a supernovae. So this is kind of, this plane is divided basically by the time that it takes for type 1a supernovae to enrich the ISM. So basically, the stars up here just don't see any of the ejecta from Type 1a supernovae, whereas the stars down here do. And you can see also the recent simulations by Clark et al., including Victor de Batista, where they look at this as well, and they see that the same process happens, but on very small scales. So that's great. It looks like an analytical model, so why would we want to spend all the time and money on doing cosmological simulations, like I mentioned before? Well, the interesting thing is that when you look at the individual galaxies, you actually see this massive diversity. So, just like Andrew showed, most of them have these unimodal, kind of low alpha, alpha to ion planes. So you kind of just see one track in alpha to ion space, and everything looks like just kind of like a closed box model. And in fact, most of the galaxies look like this. And then if you look at some of the galaxies, they have just high alpha tracks, with very few stars in the low alpha region. And that makes up kind of 15% of the galaxies. But then most interestingly is when you look at just a very small fraction of those galaxies, they actually have these bimodal alpha to ion planes. And everybody's going to like go crazy and say this doesn't really look like the Milky Way. But the thing is that we see many different varieties of appearance in this plane, and we kind of just wanted to fix on one thing that is representative of the Milky Way, and that's the fact that you see two populations in alpha to ion space at fixed metallicity. So in the simulations, amongst this 5% of galaxies, we see some which extend to higher metallicities, some which just have a kind of blob up here. You see many different kind of morphologies of this plane. I think that's really interesting and something that I'd like to study further in the future. No. So we didn't look in terms of azimuthal position.
No, I mean with galactic.
Right. So this is just selecting stars that were around. I think it's 0.5 at the scale length to 1.5 times the scale length in a kind of polo shaped.
I think it'll be really interesting to see how it varies.
Yeah.
The distance from the center.
Exactly. Yeah. Something we kind of we're going to do in a follow-up paper, but I haven't had time to do that yet. If you look at the centers of these galaxies, you actually see that this high alpha population really kind of bursts out, so that a lot of those stars are in the center of the galaxy. And just like Andrew showed, if you kind of do the Hayden et al. Thing, you see what you would expect in these populations. So the structure of those things is kind of consistent with what we would see. But we tried to avoid that because obviously Eagle has slightly lower resolution. The scale heights of the galaxies are affected by the prescriptions that we put in for gas cooling, especially in Eagle. So we kind of wanted to avoid doing the spatial thing and just look at the properties of the element enrichment. And it's kind of interesting because we're seeing this bimodality in so many of these zoom simulations that model the cold gas phases as well. But it's interesting that we seem to get these bimodalities without even having any of those kind of cold gas phase ISM, right? So you don't need the intense cooling or anything like that to produce these high star formation efficiency environments that you form these high alpha populations in. You see 20% of these galaxies that are kind of just ambiguous, right? They have crazy alpha to ion planes and there's all sorts of things going on. So you do see some that are trimodal. You also see some where there's like just two blobs, so you wouldn't classify it as bimodal at fixed metallicity like the Milky Way. So that's kind of, we wanted to isolate the thing that we know the Milky Way has, and it's bimodal alpha at fixed metallicity. But there are plenty of galaxies where you see kind of two populations but separated in metallicity. So it's difficult to kind of think about those in the same way as the Milky Way, if you like. But it's really nice because you're seeing just a huge diversity of these things within the one simulation. So if we can do bigger, larger volume simulations, we can really nail down the statistics. Of course, the important thing here is that this, in this simulation at least, it seems like the Milky Way might be rare on the basis of its stellar abundances. So we wanted to kind of delve a little bit deeper into what the formation pathways for these populations were. So we made a resimulation of one of the galaxies, the smaller volume simulations, which unfortunately doesn't have many of these bimodal galaxies because they're very statistically rare. But you can kind of see that there's a few that have these spreads in alpha abundances. And we resimulated them at high temporal resolution in order to trace the gas abundance evolution before the gas particles turned into stars. So what I'm showing you here is an alpha to ion plane of one of these galaxies. I've taken chunks out of the alpha to ion plane and then traced the stars which form inside that chunk and traced their gas particles back to the very initial conditions of the simulations and traced their abundances through time. So you can see here, this is the track that the gas which forms the stars which end up in this box takes through the abundant space, and similarly for a kind of low alpha population. And the interesting thing is that the gas kind of evolves along these different tracks in abundant space. And you don't see sort of any kind of dilution. So the gas which forms these low alpha populations doesn't kind of get enriched to high alpha and then kind of diluted later on. But when you weight these by the star formation rate, you actually and just look at the abundance evolution of all the gas, you kind of see this line that goes between the populations, which I'm not showing here. But you do see that you can kind of reproduce what you would see in our analytical model if you just include everything and weight it by the star formation rate. And then in a different way, what you can look at then is the spatial evolution of the gas which forms these two populations and see how that evolved in terms of its accretion onto the galaxy. So what I'm showing you here is the radius at which the gas particles are as a function of time before they form their stars. So the points here basically just tell you how fast the stars are forming. It tells you when 75, 50, and 25% of the gas is depleted. And what you can see is that the gas which forms the high alpha populations expands with the Hubble flow and turns off much more quickly than the low alpha gas, which takes a longer time to accrete onto the galaxy. So this kind of looks something like a 2-info model. You're seeing that the high alpha gas basically just collapses onto the galaxy at very early times, forms all of its stars in a very rapid star formation event, whereas the low alpha star forming gas kind of idles along and reaches the galaxy at much later times and forms its stars in a slower phase of star formation. So the gas which forms these populations seems to be quite different in terms of its history. So that's great, but we wanted to know really, you know, we've got all of these galaxies, can we detect anything there that is kind of a more fundamental driving factor behind the bimodality that you're seeing in these galaxies? So what we thought to look at was the mass accretion history of these galaxies in a dark matter only simulation. So we took the dark matter version of Eagle, so with no baryonic physics, traced the same halos back through the simulation and traced their mass within a virial radius as a function of time. So I'm just showing you here the median mass accretion history for all of those 133 Milky Way stellar mass galaxies compared to an analytic estimate based on the redshift zero halo mass of that set of galaxies. And what you can see is that if you take all of the galaxies together, the mass accretion history agrees pretty well with an analytic estimate. But then when you isolate the bimodal galaxies and plot their mass accretion histories, you see that they have these crazy atypical accretion histories of dark matter, which lie well above the rest of the galaxies in the sample, but also kind of diverge from the trend you would expect given a kind of normal accretion history for a cosmological dark matter halo. So this is really interesting because you get this kind of rapid buildup of dark matter in these bimodal galaxies. They're kind of on a trajectory to be very high halo mass, and then they kind of don't accrete much matter later on. So it seems like something strange is going on early in the history of these bimodal galaxies. So this is great. It presents us with a nice set of predictions for the Milky Way as a galaxy and maybe ways that we can interpret what we're seeing in the Milky Way. So it suggests galaxies that are chemically similar to the Milky Way should be pretty rare at this star mass. So that's difficult to test by just looking at the Milky Way. We're going to need extra galactic observations to do that. And trying to work out how we can see alpha bimodality in external galaxies is a challenge which I think will be exciting to solve in the next few years or maybe even decades. But in terms of predictions for the Milky Way, it makes some really nice kind of qualitative predictions. It says that the high alpha population should be pretty centrally concentrated because they form these early collapses and form all of their stars very instantaneously. It says that the kinematic and orbital structure of these things should be quite different because the high alpha stars formed in a collapse, whereas the low alpha stars form in a gradual accretion phase and probably form an extended disk. And it also says that the Milky Way's accretion history should be extremely atypical. So if we can somehow look at the accretion history of the Milky Way and integrate that over time, it should look extremely extremely different to the kind of what you would expect given its halo mass. And I think we're in a great position to kind of test those observations, test those predictions observationally using Gaia and Apigee. And I'm going to show you some of the results that we got from those data sets towards trying to test some of these predictions. And then I'm not going to get onto it today, but I'm really interested in understanding how we can actually test this prediction and maybe what the Zoom simulations might be able to tell us about that as well. So in terms of observations, I'm really interested in using these mono-age, monometallicity populations as a way of disentangling the processes of the Milky Way's formation. So abundances alone aren't probably enough to tell us what's going on in the Milky Way, and I believe age is the most important thing to kind of disentangle that. So I'm just showing you some results from my most recent paper where we've extrapolated astroseismic ages onto spectroscopic samples. So you train a neural network to recognize the features in the spectrum which correlate with age, and use that to predict ages for the whole of the apogee sample, for example. I'm just showing you here the alpha versus age, the iron versus age, and the alpha to iron then colored by age. Unfortunately, the color scale doesn't show up extremely well on this projector. But you can already see that there's a lot of interesting features when you look at these planes. If you look at alpha to iron versus age, you can see that the low alpha population splits up into all of these different tracks in terms of their metallicities, and the high alpha population pretty much looks like a kind of blob up there at old age and high alpha to iron. And then you can see in the age versus metallicity plane, the high alpha population kind of forms a distinct track or sequence, if you like, and the low alpha population kind of forms this huge cloud at very different metallicities, which is kind of represented here as well. And you can see in the alpha to iron plane that pretty much all of those high alpha stars seem to be pretty old, and there's actually kind of a gradient in age in the low alpha populations. But to really disentangle these things, you need to look at maybe the kinematics and the structures, and that's kind of what I did throughout my PhD. So in my first paper in 2017, what we found was that the Milky Way disk seems to be made up of these donuts, but it's really only the low alpha disk. So what I'm showing you here is the surface density, the log surface density as a function of radius, of low alpha populations, color-coded by their metallicity, and the transparency tells you about which of those populations is dominant in terms of mass. But what you can see from this plot is that all of those low alpha disk populations at young age are basically represented by these kind of donut-shaped annuli, where the density kind of peaks and then declines after it. And the peak radius is basically correlated with the metallicity, because there's a metallicity gradient in the Milky Way. So the low alpha disk is extended and has these donut-shaped annuli, but most interestingly for this talk, the high alpha disk populations don't seem to show these donuts to high significance and appear to be extremely centrally concentrated. And to really test this, we need to get observations further into the galaxy, but so far it seems like the high alpha disk has a completely different structure radially to the low alpha disk. So that's kind of a tick on that first prediction from Eagle. The next thing you can look at is the kinematics. So we then took those mono-age, mono-metallicity populations and measured their kinematics. So I've recently just submitted this paper. But I'm just going to show you one of the results from that, or a couple of the results from that. And what I'm showing you here is the ratio of the vertical to radial velocity dispersion as a function of age, and then colored by the mean radius of the orbits in each of those age metallicity populations, which at fixed age basically corresponds to the metallicity. And the open points show you the high alpha population, and the closed points show you the low alpha population. And just without really like delving into the details of this plot, you can see that the kinematics of those two things are completely different. So we're seeing a gradient in the ratio as a function of radius for the low alpha populations. The high alpha populations, which are all centrally concentrated, appear to just have a single value of this ratio. And that kind of tells you something about the history of the disk dynamically, I think. So in the paper, we tried to interpret this using some classical results and some of the more recent results now from numerical simulations. And what you can kind of tell is that the populations which are in the outer disk, so these low metallicity, sort of intermediate age populations, appear to have the signatures of being more heated by satellites and external perturbations. So you see an increase of the velocity dispersion with radius in those populations, and also an increase in this this ratio, because the vertical velocity dispersion basically has an excess. You also then see that the inner disk populations have a kind of low value of this ratio, and I think that indicates that there's been more spiral arm heating, because you're basically seeing an extension of the velocity ellipsoid in radius, because the spiral arms kind of sweep the stars out radially. But then, again, the high alpha population just looks completely different, takes on a single value of this ratio, and doesn't really appear to vary that much with age or radius. But I must mention that the age errors are quite large here, so it's likely that there's some contamination between those bins, but it's still kind of compelling that the high alpha population just looks different to the low alpha population in some way. So, say again? Maybe, yeah, I mean, that's one way of interpreting it, but it also looks different in terms of the way the velocity dispersions vary with height, so I won't have time to show it here. But if you look at the way that the velocity dispersion changes with height, or the ratio of the velocity dispersions changes with height above the midplane, you see some distinct differences between the two things. You can also then look at the mean velocities of those mono-age populations. So we fit a Gaussian into these things, but we allow it to vary, the mean velocity of those things to vary slightly. And what you find is that the low alpha populations, which are extended in radius, show this distinct warp signature. So you see that the mean vertical velocity kind of increases with radius for those populations. I'll just remind you, I'm showing the mean radius of the orbits in those. So this is the guiding center of the orbits in those mono-age populations rather than the exact radius. So this probably doesn't tell you the exact amplitude of the warp, if you like. But then you can see that there's actually a difference in terms of age as well, which is kind of interesting that that these older stars, which are a bit hotter, don't seem to be like taking part in the warp, which is kind of interesting. And then following on from what Shervin was talking about, you kind of see this nice wiggle in the radial velocity as a function of radius as well. But again, the high alpha stars are pretty much clumped at a single mean velocity, single mean radius as well, and don't really show a lot of variation at all. So I'm going to say that's another tick for predictions from Eagle, maybe because I'm biased. But then, so that's fine. Okay, so maybe you know that's something that we might predict from other alpha bimodality models. But something that we predicted from Eagle specifically was that the Milky Way should have this kind of atypical accretion history. And a really interesting result that came out of Gaia DR2, and I'm pretty sure we're going to hear about this a lot, is the Gaia Enceladus sausage, whatever you want to call it. So essentially, when you look in the magnesium to iron plane, we did this day two of Gaia DR2, and noticed that for apogee stars, in the abundance plane, if you color by the orbital eccentricity, you see that there's this crazy excess of stars with very radial orbits at low metallicity and kind of intermediate magnesium to iron. And I just did this without really knowing anything about the astrophysics of the stellar halo, and it turns out people have kind of known that this thing may have been there for quite a while. But really interestingly, because we have apogee abundances for these things, you can kind of isolate the stars with high eccentricities, look at their abundances in different planes. So this is a plane that Keith Hawkins showed was maybe useful in detecting accreted populations onto the Milky Way. And when you look at the stars with those high eccentricities, which are colored in blue here, they seem to have kind of distinct abundances from the rest of the stars in the halo. So the low eccentricity stars are kind of shown in the pink points. You can see that their magnesium abundances are different, but their aluminium abundances are very similar. But low aluminium abundances are generally an indication that you're looking at an accreted population. So we thought we'd discovered something huge here, but it turned out everybody else also stumbled upon the thing at the same time and decided to give it different names. And we're still trying to decide what we're going to call it and maybe even what it's even made of. But regardless of that, we decided to go and look at Eagle again and try and understand what Eagle could tell us about what this is saying for the Milky Way. So we took element abundances of accreted satellites onto Milky Way mass halos in Eagle. So each of these points here represents a single galaxy which has been accreted onto a Milky Way mass halo in Eagle. And look at their magnesium versus iron abundances. And you can see that they agree really nicely with what we see in the observations. So I'm just showing you kind of representative central Eagle galaxies here, and you can see that the accreted satellites kind of lie underneath the low alpha group kind of towards the end of it of its extension in metallicity, and you can see that they agree pretty nicely and have this really nice correlation with stellar mass. So the lower stellar mass things have a kind of dispersion in magnesium but lower metallicities, and as you move to higher and higher stellar mass you kind of fill up these different lines in the abundant space. And then if you just plop the mean abundance of the high eccentricity stars from apogee and Gaia onto this plane, you see that it gives us kind of a prediction for the stellar mass of Gaia, Enceladus, or whatever you want to call it, of about 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9. So the simulations are kind of helping us to predict the mass of Gaia, Enceladus. But they also tell us that this kind of accretion event should be actually quite rare. So when we looked at so what I'm showing you here is the median eccentricity of accreted satellite stars at redshift zero versus the redshift that they merged onto the galaxies. And what you can see is that this is a really nice trend where you have this maximum eccentricity at a given time the satellite debris can get at redshift zero. And I think this is kind of a symptom of the fact that the halo growth kind of dictates the maximum eccentricity that accreted debris can have. So if you have small halos in the early universe, their viro radii are small, so the cross-section for an impact to have a high eccentricity is extremely small. So statistically, these things are kind of unlikely in the early universe, and they become increasingly more likely as halos kind of grow. But it also predicts that these mergers should be extremely rare because we only detect a few of these in the full sample of Milky Way mass halos. And then interestingly, when we went back to our paper on the bimodality, we see that if you look at individually at these mass accretion histories, again, they're kind of different to the analytic estimates, but they all have these kind of bumps. And I'm wondering whether these are actually now consistent with something like Gaia Enceladus. And it's really interesting that Andrew pointed out that you see a similar thing happening in the fire simulations. So I'm going to say that maybe we've got a tick as well on the atypical accretion history, and that leaves me to question how we can test this rarity of the galaxy on extra galactic scales. I'm just going to leave you now with my summary there.
Comment and question. So a comment is to echo your enthusiasm and plea that I think testing this outside of the Milky Way is absolutely key. And I encourage us to think about what it might take to be able to measure alpha abundances in, say, M31 or M33, because that's a key. I mean, it's interesting that we seem to be agreeing that this should not be typical of most sort of L-star galaxies. Question. I wasn't quite clear. Do you agree or not that these are generally merger-driven? I wasn't quite clear if you see scenarios that multimodal alpha abundances could be generated in non-mergers.
Yeah, so, I mean, this was something that we hadn't touched on in the paper that we wrote. But then looking back at it, it looks like maybe these things are having these mergers. And
so
that's
we may agree, in fact.
Yeah, we're kind of working on quickly now to try and see if these things are gas-rich and where the gas from those things ends up and whether that forms stars from there. But yeah, it's interesting. And then, but in some cases, maybe the differences in these alpha planes is dictated by whether they're kind of merger-driven or accretion-driven, potentially.
I think that's a key question.
Yeah. So that's something that we're going to look at soon. Yeah. But it was kind of a thing that it was a question when we were finishing up the Eagle paper.
So I wanted to ask a question about the satellites coming in on a radial orbit, because I think from looking at your plot, you're saying that the chance that it comes in on a radial orbit gets higher and higher the closer you get to now.
Oh, okay, yeah. So
is that correct?
Yeah, well, yeah. So it seems, I mean, this is how we interpret it, just like in a hand-wavy way in our paper.
Yeah, because it's my understanding the reason that people thought that this thing was 10 gigayears, Gaia Enceladus is 10 gigayears in the past, was because that's what the simulations told us to expect for radial mergers, right? Isn't that right? And what you're saying is that you would expect it to be radial, you mean even more likely. You know,
right, yeah, that's so.
At more recent.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know if that's the comment. Well,
but
I was asking him for clarification, but if you want to comment, I'd be
so happy. Something that I'll add here is that this is the eccentricity once the stars have kind of mixed into the sort of the halo that is it descendant? so that kind of there is some maybe we're not looking at the eccentricity that the thing came in on. Right, go, Vasily.
I the mic. So we don't really. I think what we see is the evolution of the eccentricity of the massive progenitor, and it can come with actually a range of angular momentum and end up on highly radial final kind of disruption where it gives birth to this cloud of stars in the stellar halo. So I don't understand this particular argument where you see so it actually doesn't matter really if it was massive enough with what angular momentum it came. It has ability to lose it and end up radializing.
Yeah, so it's difficult to say whether this is something just from Eagle in the way that the numerics may be. But we did test this. We used a higher resolution simulation, a larger volume simulation, and some of the ones with different physics. And you don't see this thing changing. So I'm just wondering, it could be like a definitions thing. I don't know. But it's interesting that from the process, that kind of process, your suggestion does seem to make sense, right?
So what don't you see changing? You said, we don't see this thing changing.
This trend doesn't kind of go away. If you increase the resolution of the simulation, the sort of maximum envelope thing doesn't change. With a appreciable, so we double the resolution, essentially. So there's a high resolution version of Eagle, and you don't see this thing change in resolution or volume.
I'm going to take chair's prerogative, and then we'll let Rosie go, if you don't mind. So just one quick comment based on the merger kind of related issue. I think anytime you have a merger, if you have a merger that brings in that number of stars, that would create this kind of Gaia Enceladus kind of thing, roughly at redshift 1 or even if it was even earlier, that's going to be gas rich. And so that will bring in gas that should contribute substantially and affect the star formation history and chemical evolution of the system. It just seems natural that something like that should happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. I have a comment and a question. And the comment is that if you accept that a sufficiently massive and dense satellite is when it merges, is going to heat a thin disk into a thick disk, just looking at the age distribution of the thick disk, which is old, can tell you that there hasn't been a very massive merger in the Milky Way for a long time, and that itself makes it an unusual accretion history in Lambda CEM.
Exactly, yeah, and I agree with you there, and that kind of tells you that you're probably looking at the very maximum part of this envelope. Yeah. So that's kind of what we were getting at with the, so yeah, I think we agree on that point.
Good, and my question is, could you just remind us what are the main differences in the baryonic physics between the Eagle simulations and the FIRE simulations?
So the main difference is that in Eagle, we're not modeling the cold ISN. Because the resolution is kind of insufficient to model those kind of cold scales. So we basically employ this kind of temperature floor to say the ISM can only reach this temperature, and then once it's at that temperature, it's forming stars, so we don't allow it to kind of fragment into these tiny pockets of... Whereas in FIRE, they're adding in subgrid physics for the ISM, and they're resolving those scales so that they can kind of do that. That's the main difference, essentially.
So what does that limit in your simulations? You don't get as thin disks?
Essentially, it limits the vertical extent of the gas disks that you can get. Yeah. There's a couple of papers by Alejandro Benitez Lambe and another one by Julio Navarro that showed that maybe this is not so much of an issue in Eagle. But in general, the disks are thicker because there's this temperature floor, so the gas sort of buoyancy is locked in to a certain extent. Okay.
Gravitational softening is bigger than a 200 parsec. It's difficult to resolve a 300 parsec.
Right. Yeah. So I think the Benitez Lambe paper basically showed that it's not actually the temperature floor which is imposing this thing, it's the gravitational softening.
Just short question. Where did you measure the eccentricity of the accreted satellite debris in the Eagle simulations?
So where did we measure it there?
Where did you measure it? Is it all the accreted satellite?
Yeah, so we took all of the particles.
But your sample in the disk is in a very special location.
Right, no, in this case, we basically just find all of the satellite particles that have merged into the galaxy and measure their eccentricity.
The disk itself is in a very special spot. So the question would be, how much bias do you have by sampling the total debris?
So you mean that the observations are sampling
it? Let's take an example where something gets accreted to a large galactocentric radius.
Yep.
Mean, all the stars that I observe locally will have exceedingly large eccentricity because they need to penetrate down to me. And so if I take something like that, I can't compare all the particles in my simulation to what I measure locally. And you should, I think, at least see a larger scatter of the observed values when you take a particular subset of the satellite.
Mm-hmm. I think, that's an interesting point. It's something that we couldn't do in Eagle because I'm showing here basically the small points are the ones where we had less than 100 particles, whereas the large points are the ones where we had more than that. So we've only got a very few particles to actually test this with in Eagle. But it'd be interesting to look at something like that, maybe the bias that you get kinematically. But I mean, is this something that people think we're seeing with the sausage? Or,
no, because we see the distribution of stars throughout the halo, and these are alive, right? And they're not limited to solid and all the made alone. So it doesn't really matter where you sample the sausage between its radio and highly eccentric. So this affects the non. I mean, the effect of your phase space density, right? Because you're not sampling all the velocity, because you're only sampling a section. Slicing the guy's spiral, but otherwise it's so radial wherever you look at it. So, yeah. And with regards to the age, why it's 10 dB is, I think because it's very smooth overall.
I don't think it is very smooth overall.
There are bits to it that are not smooth, but if you look again.
It's not smooth.
Well, if you look at the bulk of their lyra, it's pretty smooth. Right? So if you just take all their lyra that are all the same way.
Very smooth. Stars.
Pardon?
The only stars by selection.
But they have particular orbital properties that allow you to associate them with this mirror.
Well, we were seeing some structure when we were just not just our
letter.
So I think there is some structure.
I don't think it's completely smooth, but I think it is more.
I thought you also said that Virgo was part of it, and Virgo is not smooth. Well, it's 40 degrees on the sky.
But I'm not saying it's completely smooth, but it's smooth enough to be not to be super dense.
The local velocity of its sort of higher stars is the most eccentric that we find within the entire arm. It's most elevated in the radial direction. If you go further away from the disk, as far as I know, basically all results point to a rounding of the velocity of its sort to some extent.
Okay, so I have the talking stick here, so I'm gonna ask a question because I was given the talking stick, and it's related to what we're discussing. So, do I understand correctly that these simulations, while they produce the sausage feature, they don't, at the same time, produce the phase space spiral that was seen in Gaia data? Is that correct?
Well, so in Eagle, you're really affected by the resolution to do the kinematics, right? So, so we don't really look into that at all, and that's kind of the reason we need these zooms, right?
They have nothing to do with each other.
I know. I mean, it's just a question. I mean, so what about in Fire? Do you happen to?
I know nothing about Fire.
Okay.
But I know. I mean, we doing the kinematics is hard. Looking at things just like the eccentricity of a whole satellite is fine in Eagle, but doing things like the detailed like kinematics of the disk, something that we try not to touch on, because you basically see everything has a velocity dispersion of 100, and that's just because of this cold gas phase stuff and we don't resolve things like GMCs as well, so you're not seeing heating from those things. So we kind of just avoided that entirely. But
okay.
Yeah.
Let's let Jerry. I think it's gonna be the last word.
Okay. You said you extracted 133 Milky Way-like galaxies from your Eagle simulation. By what criterion were they specified to be Milky Way-like?
Right.
And did you take into account something very crude like halo mass, or did you take it? Was it the second brightest, second heaviest galaxy in a small group, or was it the something with a satellite distribution like the Milky Way? I mean, it matters a lot.
Yeah, that's interesting. So. What we wanted to do was keep it as simple as possible and just say, at the Milky Way, so we took the stellar mass of the Milky Way and just took galaxies from that which had a disk. So we basically just said, if it's got a disk, and so we're not saying they're Milky Way-like, they're just Milky Way, stellar mass, and disk galaxies. So because what we wanted to do was say, at this stellar mass, what's the frequency of seeing alpha band variety?
So, heterogeneous.
Right, yeah, so it doesn't really, yeah, so you maybe would expect a lot of diversity anyway. Because I guess if you kind of maybe, that was something that we wanted to look at, and it's actually very difficult to do, is to like do things like that and say, are the galaxies which are bimodal those ones which are only in these kind of configurations like we mentioned? And so yeah, but what we wanted to do is kind of get the statistics for the stellar mass range and stick with that. So
okay, 30 seconds. People should look at Cauchy and Tully's beautiful work on the local environment. Essentially, all L stars are in groups of two or three galaxies. It's quite remarkable. So I'd like to know if your Milky Way analogs are local group analogs as well, because that's something you should be able to match.
At least one of these has a massive Andromeda-like halo. I didn't look at all of them. I just know one of them has because I've done a movie of it.
Okay. I'm going to make my original point, which is, it looks like this plot, if this dependence is a thing, which it's still just a geometric argument, so I have no problem with that, it looks like things that high eccentricity are just more likely to have merged more recently, rather than that they're necessarily rare, plot is telling me, which is consistent with our picture of Enceladus.
We kind of tried, the rarity argument is mainly made on the combination of this and the mass, right? So seeing a high mass merger and this eccentricity is maybe saying it's rare. So I think we did the statistics in the paper. I can't think of it off the top of my head now, but we did like the percentage of galaxies with that eccentricity, the percentage with that eccentricity, and the predicted mass of Enceladus based on the Helmy et al. Result, and it comes out basically like the same sort of 6%, 5% region of galaxies have these mergers.
All right, let's keep talking over break, and we'll be back.